Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that shape, challenge, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. Today, we're exploring a language we all speak, yet few of us ever study, the language of nonverbal communication. From our facial expressions and gestures to vocal tone, eye contact, posture, and even the colors we wear, these verbal behaviors shape how others see us and how we interpret the world around us. Joining me is Dr. Stephen A. Furlish, author of the book Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. Dr. Furlish breaks down the science behind the signals we send out without words, revealing how biology, culture, and psychology intersect to influence trust, communication, connection, and understanding in every corner of our lives, at work, in relationships, and in daily relations. We'll dive into the silent messages we send and ones we miss. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and joining me via Zoom platform, I welcome Dr. Stephen Furlish. Welcome to 411 Teen.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your interest in the topic.
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. I loved it. Your book emphasizes that people overlook nonverbal cues. Why do we miss so much of what others are saying?
That's a good question. So a lot of our thinking and a lot of our communication is more in the subtle subconscious type of level. And if we are not aware of that, then it often goes unnoticed. But if you educate yourself and become more aware of what to look at or what to look for and have a deeper understanding, then people can start to recognize that and be more cognizant of it. I could give one example.
Sure.
Okay, so one example, and this is something that I covered this semester in my class, and it pretty much played out this way. So there is a biological universal type of nonverbal greeting that everybody has across cultures, and that's the eyebrow flash. So when you see someone who you are happy to see, someone who's positive to see, we do a quick flash with our eyebrows, raise in and lower them quickly. Most people do not notice this, but it's something that we all do. But if you become aware of it, and if you understand the meaning behind it, then you do notice it at a conscious level, and you can pick up on it, and you can intentionally display it as well. So basically, it's just you see someone comes into your visual sight, you make eye contact with them, your eyebrows raise and lower in less than a second. And what that does is it's a friendly greeting that allows you to take a more visual information of the other person. But there's other examples I have as well, but I'll stop here.
Okay. Well, you discuss how physical features shape our impressions. And that was an example, but what kinds of features carry the strongest weight? And I'm thinking about now eyes, facial symmetry, posture.
Okay, those are all good examples.
Okay.
So one of the things that people should probably be aware of is that emotions are universal, and it's still to some degree some debate how many there are universal emotions, mm-hmm. 5 to 7, but everyone experiences these same emotions, but we display them differently based upon our culture. So if we're in more of a individualistic type of culture, which we tend to be more in the U.S., then we tend to be much more expressive with our nonverbal behaviors. Whereas if we're in a collectivistic culture in the Far East, then people don't bring as much individual attention to themselves. It's much more of a subtle type of thing. Something else to keep in mind in terms of these physical types of display is that when someone starts their facial displays, if it starts on the left side of their face, then that's usually a truer indication of genuineness. And also what happens quickest as well and what happens first. So these micro expressions. So what happens quickest, what happens first, and on the left side, then those are usually truer types of facial displays that people can take into account that this is more of what is actually their true feelings behind what they're actually displaying.
How much control do we truly have over these impressions?
That's a good question. So one of the things to keep in mind is that you're looking at nonverbal communication as a piece of the puzzle. So that's something to really keep in mind. That I think oftentimes people often give too much weight to one specific behavior. Mm-hmm. So one of the major principles throughout the book is that you're putting all these individual evidence together to come up with an educated type of guess. So one of the chapters that we cover nonverbal epiphany, that I cover nonverbal epiphany, is deception. So that seems like one of the things that you're addressing mm-hmm. to some degree mm-hmm. is how much control do people have and how much is it more biological and instinctual? So some behaviors are more biological and instinctual, and other ones you can intentionally try to display. So professionals who try to detect deception, they only do it with about 60% accuracy. So you're looking at maybe interrogators, maybe FBI, police officers, whoever else who are professionally trained, they only do it slightly above chance itself of 50-50% because it's very difficult. And they probably haven't read my book.
I was going to say that. I was.
So after reading my book, then you could get to a much higher level than 60%. But, so some things to look for in terms of deception is for right-handed people, mm-hmm. if they look to the left, while they're recalling what it is that you're asking about, that's usually more of a truthful type of response that activates the right side of the brain. Whereas with right-handed people, if they look to the right, then that's often uh-huh. something that's false. That's something that they're trying to fabricate that activates the left side of the brain. So for right-handed people, if they look to the left, that's usually more truthful. Looking to the right, that's usually more fabricated or false. So you can think of left as being literal. Uh-huh. Also, something that people usually get incorrect when it comes to deception is what do people usually look for? They look for eye contact. And what researchers actually found was that people who are trying to deceive, the more they're trying to deceive, they actually make more eye contact mm-hmm. than normal. Mm-hmm. And that's probably because that's what people are taught in popular culture and whatever else. So that brings us into another principle. So we talked about pieces of the puzzle. And another principle is baseline. How does someone normally communicate? And are they communicating differently than how they normally do? So with their length of eye contact, how long do they normally keep eye contact before they break it? So you ask some simple questions first, maybe weather, sports, news, and then you go into more detail about what you want to find out if they're being deceptive or not. So you set that baseline first. Also, and this is something that I think you're trying to get at as well, what people don't monitor intentionally nearly as much are the extremities. So the farther you are from the core of the body, the less people monitor those. So usually the feet tell. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to a holiday party, you're having a conversation with someone, one foot is pointed towards you during the conversation, another foot is pointed towards the door, they're not monitoring that, and that's usually what their more true intention is, that they want to leave that conversation, and the door captures more of their attention.
I love this. Oh, excuse me for interrupting, but I just thought your book was fascinating. I mean, I just want to commend you on it. And anybody that has just an inkling of interest would love this book. So I strongly recommend it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And also look at what others are looking at. So if you have three different items in front of someone and they're staring at one, that's what their intention is. And it's usually more truthful of what their intention is or their interest is. So maybe in sales or something else. Poker players, you watch on maybe ESPN, a poker tournament, and what do? They all have those sunglasses on. Mm-hmm. So the way to tell deception is, again, going back to what we talked about as another principle, the extremities. So their hands, how do they place their chips and their bet and move the chips towards the middle of the table? Do they look confident in the way that they move it, or do they look hesitant? And that's often an indicator of their extremities and how they control that. Deception usually involves more repetitive, simple behaviors. So what are you doing when you're trying to deceive? You're trying to rehearse verbally what that lie is and keep that consistent. So you don't have natural types of nonverbal behaviors. They're also often more simple and the same ones over and over because it's not a natural thing. It's difficult to do. Recall the lie verbally and then have natural types of nonverbal behaviors. So you just do the same simple ones over and over. So it's less spontaneous. And then lastly, this is a good suggestion, is that biological females are much better at detecting deception than what males are. So bring a female into the equation and have them try to analyze the other person, and then also have groups of people all, often outperform the individuals when trying to tell if someone's being deceptive or not. So those are some of the things that people don't control in terms of which way you look, their extremities, how much they use nonverbal types of gestures, things like that.
What about color? You wrote how color choices communicate traits. I would wonder if you would share some examples of what research shows about the psychology of color and how colors, you know, indeed may trigger emotional responses so quickly. I mean, I thought that was very interesting. I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts, so I don't want to have you start and then we have to stop because we're going to take a quick break very shortly. And let me reintroduce you to folks. You've tuned in to 411 Teen. I am talking with Dr. Stephen Furlich. He is the author of Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we will get right back at you. And at that point, we'll start to talk about color choices. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Dr. Stephen Furlich, author of Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. Dr. Furlich, before we went on break, I mentioned color and wanted to have you, you know, address the impact of color and what color, what the research says about the psychology of color.
Yes. And again, just like with your intro at the start of the show, you mentioned or addressed how there are certain things that affect us that we're not aware of, and colors are one of those things. That if we become more cognitively aware of it, then we could use it to our benefit and also recognize what types of effects it has on us. So for anyone out there who has to give presentations, using some sort of technology, multimedia, PowerPoint, whatever else, warm colors such as the red and the yellow, when you use more of those in your presentation visual aids, that increases audience's comprehension. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what these warm colors often do, it increases our energy levels. It makes us feel much more energized. It invigorates us. We feel much more motivated as a response. So it makes sense that people will comprehend more when they have higher levels of energy. There's also memory color. So what types of things do we have from our past experiences that we're used to seeing a certain color? And what does that do when something is presented to us? So, for example, when water is presented and given in a cup that's a blue cup, people rate that as being more refreshing than if it's going to be given in a yellow cup. Same water, same temperature, just the color of the cup differs, and people rate it more refreshing blue because that's what we associate with refreshing and water itself.
Okay.
One of the things that we talked about also was these bright colors. These bright colors are much more arousing, such as the red. It captures our attention, the yellow. So if, next time you go out to eat, if you go to a place to eat that's maybe a fast food place, look around what types of colors are all around. Usually the yellow, the bright colors, because they're not making a lot of money off of you as an individual. They're making it off of the quantity that they sell. So they want you in, out, and eat a lot more by having more stimulation from these brighter types of colors. These cool colors, these blues, these dark greens, they're much more relaxing. So they put us in a much more calmer type of mood. One of the things that you should look around this time of season as well, businesses, what color do they have in their logos? So the financial firms, I can't think of any financial firm that doesn't have blue in their logo. You have a lot of the big tech companies, they tend to have blue in their logo. Look at Amazon, look at Facebook, Meta, they have blue. And we associate the color of blue with trust. Why is that? Because that's what we have been conditioned. If you go outside, you look up, the sky is blue. If you look out the ocean's blue. So the sky has always been around. The ocean has always been around. So we associate the color of blue with trust. And that's why a lot of businesses put that in their logos as well. Biological females, they tend to have superior color vision. There's that one image in one of the chapters that hopefully you were able to see. And there's a male on one end, on the female on the other end of all these different color spectrums. And you can see how many different colors that the female can see that the male can't, because part of color vision is in the X chromosome. So biological females have two X chromosomes. Males only have one, and that's where color part of color vision is. You can see how females can see more different shades, more nuances when it comes to color. So biological females need to give us a little bit of leniency when it comes to our color choices of gifts, clothes that we wear, whatever else. Females also have more P cells in the retina, which helps with color vision. Males who wear red, females tend to find that more attractive. Female waitresses that wear a red shirt or red lipstick tend to get higher tips. Blue rooms tend to be more relaxing. Architecture, when designing certain types of structures, having a blue space becomes more relaxing. So maybe a pond or a lake or waterfalls or some type of water that's associated with it, people are more relaxed around it. And lastly, salespeople, when they wear red, they tend to be more persuasive and have more sales than if they wear a white shirt.
Do men and women differ in the way they send or interpret nonverbal cues?
That's a good question. And that probably leads to a lot of relationship conflicts.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about those too. You read me. You got it.
I like to use a few metaphors. One is you have to play with the hand that you're dealt. So poker metaphor. You can't play a hand that you don't have. Or in the stock market, you have to trade the market you have, not the one that you want. So based upon what we have biologically, that's what you have to go with. So research has found consistently year after year, decade after decade, that females from an early age are superior when it comes to nonverbal communication. And there are biological reasons for it. Early on, girls tend to have more interest in faces. So girls look at faces, boys look at objects, moving objects. Some of the biological reasons why females are superior when it comes to nonverbal communication, they have a much more, as far as I'm concerned, this science is already settled. Females have a more integrated brain, so they have more connections across both hemispheres. Whereas with males, we have more connections within each hemisphere. Females also have more white matter overall in their brain. And what the white matter does, it helps the different areas of the brain communicate with each other. So not only have an integrated brain with more connections across both hemispheres, that allows the female women to engage in conversation while at the same time analyze the other person's nonverbal behaviors. Whereas with us males having more connections within each hemisphere, we could do one or the other, but expecting us to do both at the same time, it's much more difficult. And the white matter that women have more of overall allows the different areas that are connected to communicate and send signals to each other much better, much more efficient as well. Also, women, females, they have more senses that are more sensitive as well. So on each of the five different senses, female are much more in tune to it. So they could rate or understand a greater spectrum of smells. And we already talked about colors, different shades of colors, more sensitive to touch, more sensitive to taste, and can hear a larger range as well. So females have more sensory information to go off of than what males do. They have a larger, more active insula. That's that small part of the brain that's buried deep within the brain. And that processes the sensory information. So if it's larger, more active, and they're more sensitive to each of these different areas of senses as well, you can see how they could pick up on more of the nonverbal nuances, just like we talked about. That females are superior when it comes to detecting deception in other people. And this is also a big one. They have more mirror neurons that are activated during social interactions. Those are those neurons in the brain that prepare your body to display the nonverbal behaviors that you see someone else display. So if females have more mirror neurons that are being activated, it's preparing their body to display what the nonverbal behaviors are of the other person that they see. So if you're going through the same types of cognitive and physical processes as the other person, you can see how that leads to better empathy. They also have females higher levels of oxytocin during social interactions, that bonding chemical. So when you feel more of a connection to the other person from higher levels of oxytocin during social interactions, you can see how that you can empathize and understand from the other person's perspective. They have more overall brain activation during social interactions, higher levels of estrogen. Estrogen helps with social understanding. Testosterone hinders social understanding. Some different evidence of it. Females can label emotions just by looking at the eyes, pictures of eyes of other people, much better than what males can. They also did a study where they had curtain. And all you do is you reach to the other side of the curtain and just feel the other person's hand. They can identify the other person's emotion just from touch alone. Females in a relationship, it's much easier for the female to mimic the other person's nonverbal behaviors, the male's, than it is for the male to adjust his nonverbal behaviors to mimic the female. And we know how important it is for mimicry to have positive nonverbal behaviors that match each other in a relationship, because that's a strong indicator of that both people are in sync with each other in a healthy relationship. So that's something to look forward to at holiday parties when you see a couple. How much do they mimic each other's nonverbal behaviors positively? And is it the female that's adjusting to the male? Because that's usually what's much easier to do in a relationship. And then also, this is something that's interesting from a metaphor in terms of the animal kingdom. So those creatures who like to hide, their eyes are on the side. And those who like to hunt, their eyes are in front. So same with the human in the animal kingdom. Eyes on the side like to hide. Females have a much better peripheral vision on the side. And those who like to hunt, males have a much more, much better vision straight ahead. So during conversations, what often happens is, and this has been my experience, when I'm talking to a woman, she often stands to the side of me, and that's much more difficult for me to get in the vision that I have, because as a male, I'm straight ahead. That's where I feel comfortable. But for her, the peripheral vision is where she feels comfortable. So going to a holiday party, look at two women communicate, and then look at a man and a woman communicate, and look at two males communicate, and look where are they facing each other, or is one at the side when they're communicating with each other. So here's a bottom line to take away from all that in the biological evidence that we just covered is oftentimes us males, we oversimplify what happens in a social interactions, and we take the literal meaning much more of what's being said. And sometimes females, they look into the subtleties much more so, and sometimes they overanalyze or overcomplicate. So sometimes males, we oversimplify it and don't look into the nuances non-verbally nearly as much as what we should. And that frustrates women because we don't pick up on the subtle types of communication that they drop for us to pick up on. We're just not equipped for it. And sometimes for us males, we get frustrated because sometimes females pick up on too much and look too deep into some of our non-verbal behaviors beyond what we're literally saying.
Indeed. Let's talk about handshakes. What makes a handshake send a positive versus a negative message?
That's a good question. And again, probably if you're going to some sort of social gatherings or holiday parties or whatever else, likely there's going to be some handshaking that takes place. So going back generations ago, how one start of it is that if you're thinking about maybe medieval times, people used to wear those long cloaks. So you would shake the other person's forearm to make sure that they didn't have some sort of weapon up their cloak. So and then eventually it just evolved down to shaking the other person's hand. So when you take that into consideration, what happens is if you have your palm up, so you have your knuckles down, your palm up, what's that do? That puts you into a very vulnerable position because that's a submissive handshake because you expose that vein that if someone were to slice that on your wrist, it's called to turn off that blood from leaking out. So therefore, a submissive handshake tends to have your palm up, and a dominant handshake tends to have your palm down, and then just a vertical, neutral type of handshake is what people are usually used to seeing. So in terms of level of comfort, it usually lasts about 3 seconds. It's usually slightly firm. And then also what happens naturally, and there's a lot of YouTube clips out there with politicians. And there's one that's that shows Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. She actually walked around someone so that the other person was on her left side for the photo. So what happens is if the person you're going to shake hands with is on your left side, you naturally reach across yourself and naturally your palm is down, put you in a powerful position. Whereas if someone's on your right side, you naturally extend your arm and your palm is up naturally, and that's a submissive handshake. There's also a photo out there of Nixon and Kennedy shaking hands, and Kennedy has Nixon on his left side, so he's on the dominant side, his palm is down, and Nixon gives this very disgruntled type of facial expression because his palm is exposed and it's more of a submissive type of handshake.
Well, what about the new norms? And I'm thinking now about the post-pandemic, you know, and comfort levels. How is this, and I know, does this change the ritual at all?
That's a good question. And I made a little bit of a joke in class a few weeks ago when we talked about handshakes. I was like, prior to the corona handshake, Prior to the coronavirus, people used to actually shake hands. And I said, to put in perspective how long ago that was, Nick Cannon only had three kids. And now he's up to like 11. So that tells you how much time has passed. And yeah, so with the handshake, when it comes to like the medical offices and doctor's offices, now patients see it, view it, perceive it as just as positive if the doctor walks in, makes eye contact and a smile and doesn't do the handshake. Or they see it just as positive if the doctor walks in and does a fist bump. So doing the fist bump is becoming just as socially acceptable as doing the shake of hands. And there's a 50% research has found that it's a 50% reduction of how much pathogens or viruses are transferred from person to person by doing a fist bump as opposed to doing the handshake itself. So it's becoming much more acceptable, or just doing eye contact and smile is acceptable as well. One thing to throw in there is that the benefits of a handshake is, or maybe even the fist bump itself, touch. So touch often increases oxytocin levels, that bonded chemical. So having touch increases the oxytocin levels and how much you feel connected or bonded and how much you trust someone else. So that's something else to throw into the wrinkle. So I guess trying to debate and throw all these factors in, you know, of contamination or whatever versus oxytocin and bonding versus positive types of outcomes. So it's all these factors to consider.
Okay. Well, I ask you to hold your thoughts. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I am talking with Dr. Stephen Furlich, and it's been really informative so far. So thank you. We're going to take a break, but we'll return shortly.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. I am talking with Dr. Stephen Furlich, author of Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. Dr. Furlich, research indicates that people make trust judgments within a second of meeting someone. Which nonverbal cues carry the most weight in those early moments, and why are they so powerful?
So that's a good point. So overall, first impressions are very quick, as you already talked about, and it takes a lot, several hundred contrarian impressions afterwards to change that. So people make first impressions quick, and they stay for a long time. Here's something for all you 411 younger generation, maybe students trying to get your first job, whatever else. Here's a big tip that I teach my students. You go to a job interview. There's five people out in the hallway waiting to come in. Each one walks in individually. And what does each one have in their hand? Their cell phone. And what's that communicate? How much interest do you have in the interview versus how much interest do you have in other things you have going on? So instead of having a cell phone in your hand for a job interview, walking into the classroom, wherever else, maybe carry a newspaper. Maybe carry a periodical, maybe carry something that is news related to wherever that job is. If it's for investments, maybe the Wall Street Journal or investments or Investors Business Daily. If it's something psychology related, then maybe a periodical that's related to it. We had a graduate student who went for a job interview for a faculty position. And at the university, when he walked in for the interview, he picked up the campus newspaper, and he got offered the job after that as well. So it's not entirely because he had the campus newspaper in his hand, but I think it does make a deciding factor if two people are equal on everything else. One's carrying a cell phone, one's carrying something related to the job. You can see how that comes across more serious and much more related to it. Something else we already previously talked about was the eyebrow flash. So doing the eyebrow flash with each person communicates that you're happy to see them. That's something else, non-verbally. Something else in terms of dress, appearance, dress the part. What does someone for this, maybe a job interview, what are they supposed to look like? Or for a presentation, the role that you have, what are you supposed to look like and dress that part? And then once you get the job, dress the part of the job you want, not necessarily the job that you currently have. Something else is when it comes to eye contact, and especially for the younger generation, it's usually extreme one or the other. They usually don't do much eye contact or they do too much. So you usually want to have eye contact with the other person, maybe for a couple of seconds, and then you break eye contact down each time. You never break it up. So something that can be used is the triangle method. So with the triangle method, you look at the person's left eye, and then you look at the person's right eye, and then you break eye contact to their mouth, and you go in that type of rhythm, because what that does is it helps you maintain looking at the other person, but not looking at too much eye contact with their eyes alone, because that could come across as aggressive or not having a lack of eye contact, because that could come off as being disinterested. And you always want to break eye contact down, because if you break it up, that could come across as a power play, that you're rolling your eyes at the other person. Something else to keep in mind is that if you do a slight head tilt, what that does during a social interaction, that exposes more of your neck. So think back again, like we already talked about, the animal kingdom. When you expose part of your neck, that's a vulnerable position, because that exposes that vein that's very difficult to turn off if that were to be sliced or attacked. So therefore, a slight head tilt comes across as very friendly, as that you're trying to build rapport with the other person. Okay. Something else that the nonverbal epiphany that I cover in the book is smiling. So a genuine smile from a fake one. A genuine usually lasts longer. It takes longer to create. There's usually more symmetry with the face. The cheeks are raised much higher. And there's usually more of the wrinkles to the sides of the eyes, known as the crow's feet. So creating a real genuine smile comes across as much more sincere. So I think a lot of times with first impressions, everyone's taught make eye contact and smile, but the subtleties are not taught. The subtleties of the triangle method of not having eye contact too long, breaking eye contact down, and then also having a genuine smile versus a disingenuous one.
Wow. That's a lot. Let's look at vocal changes as critical nonverbal cues. How does tone and say pacing and pitch, how are these messages received? And sometimes it can be contradicting to the words themselves. So would you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So that's another principle, what you just alluded to. If what we say contradicts what we do nonverbally, people are going to take much more into consideration what's being done nonverbally than verbally. So just as a little background information, nonverbal communication addresses the voice, everything but the specific words themselves. Mm-hmm. So the tone, the rate, the pitch, the pauses, all those fall under the umbrella of nonverbal communication. So if your voice comes across with those nonverbal elements of pitch, rate, volume, pauses, all those things differently than what you're saying, talking about something that you sound monotone about, but the topic is supposed to be exciting, people aren't going to be excited about it. If you're talking about a serious issue, but you sound like you're not taking it seriously, then people are going to take you serious as well. So with voice itself, we often learn our voice from imitating others at an early age. So that's why you can see how there are different cultural differences and how there are different types of language expressive differences based upon different cultures. If someone does a pitch change right before they're about to talk about something, then that topic is going to be remembered much more so than compared to if they keep the same volume, mm-hmm. the same level, the same speed. So having a change in your pitch can create a distinction with what you're about to say, and it gives more of a weight to what you're about to say, and people remember it. So professional speakers, look at them on TV. When they're giving a presentation, they often do a pause and then change their pitch right before something important that they want the audience to remember much more so. Spontaneous voice is believed much more so than something that sounds rehearsed. So when giving a presentation, this is why I teach my students, only have a few key words written down, mm-hmm. and then elaborate in a conversational voice beyond what's written down. Do not have complete sentences written down, all the ways it comes across as too artificial. Don't have complete sentences, and then just elaborate from a few key words. Someone who maybe more depressed, so the emotional state of depression, they often communicate more monotone and a softer voice as well. So a few things to keep take away from all this is pitch changes and pauses are important to emphasize importance for people to remember. And then spontaneous is believed more. And then you could tell someone's emotional state based upon their vocal expressiveness.
What about the professor who is pacing back and forth during his lecture?
Okay, that's a good point. And something else I forgot to point out also is, and this is becoming much more popular to at least recognize, do not end something that you're talking about with a higher pitch. Mm-hmm. If you end a sentence or an entire sentence after you talked for a few sentences, if you end in an upper type of pitch, then that comes across yes. that you're asking for permission.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like you're asking the audience for permission as opposed to more authoritative making statements. So here's something interesting with what you just talked about with pacing back and forth. And one of the things that I like to talk about in terms of stage presence are a few different things. So one is that you often start in the middle of your presentation, the middle of the stage. And with the middle of the stage, you do your introduction. And then when you go into your main point one, you take one step to the right. And then when you do your main point two, you go to the left, back to the middle. And then when you do your main point three, you take another step to the left. And then when you do your conclusion, you take a step to the right and you're back to your middle. So what that helps do is it shows your audience physical transitions to follow along during your presentation. So your intro's in the middle, and then main point one's to the right, and then you take a left. That's your main back point two, back in the middle. And then the left, that's your main point three, and then your conclusion, you're back in the middle. Here's something that's interesting that currently I submitted a manuscript to an academic journal about this, that comedians have known about this for decades. And I think there's some truth to it, that there's an old saying out there, laugh to the left, cry to the right. Mm-hmm. So if you want to make the audience laugh, you stand to the left side of the stage. So what's that do? So when you stand to the left, that's the audience, they're looking at the right visual field. Okay. So that's their right vision mm-hmm. when you stand to the left. And what that does is it activates their vision field, activates the left side of the brain. So what's the left side of the brain? That's where language and humor is more activated on the left side of the brain. So if you stand to the left, that's going to activate the audience's left side of the brain, because that's what both eyes, their visual field is going to activate the left side of the brain. And also language activates the left side of the brain, and so does humor. So that's going to compound the activation on the left side of the brain just by standing to the left. Whereas if you stand to the right side of the stage, that's the audience's left visual field. And the left visual field activates the right side of the brain. And overwhelmingly, the right side of the brain is more the emotional area of the brain. So if the left visual field of the audience from you standing on the right side activates the right side of the brain for emotion from the visual field, and what you're presenting, the information, is emotional, that's mm-hmm. going to activate the right side of the brain as well. That's going to compound it. So during okay. presentations, it's a good idea to stand on the left side if you want the audience to laugh, and on the right side when making emotional appeals. But with visual aids as well, that works as well. So with a visual aid, you have something that's emotional on the left side of your visual aid, except that's mm-hmm. emotional
okay.
on the left side, because that's going to activate the right side mm-hmm. from the visual field, and emotions activate on the right side as well. And then for a visual aid, have on the right side something that's language associated or humor on the right side, or the content itself, and that's going to activate the left side of the brain during the visual field from looking to the right, and it's going to activate the left side of the brain from the content of the humor or the language itself.
Okay. Yep. All right. This is probably the last question I can get in, and we've talked a little bit about cross-cultural communication, but some nonverbal behaviors cross cultural lines while others do not. What signals are most universal, and what do they reveal, I guess, about the shared human experience? And you got 3 minutes.
Okay. That's a good question. So we talked about one universal was the eyebrow flash. Mm-hmm. And the second universal, we talked about the real smile from a fake one. And here's a third one, pupil dilation. So oftentimes when a new stimuli, new person, whatever else comes into our visual field, what happens is in less than a second, our pupils dilate to take that information in. And then if it's something that we like, then our pupils stay dilated. If it's something that we dislike, then they contract even smaller than what they normally usually are. So salespeople often understand this. Jewelry dealers centuries ago used to wear sunglasses so that they don't tip off what they're interested in terms of trying to trade different types of things, because pupil dilation indicates you have more interest in it, and then contraction, you have less of it in mm-hmm. it. We talked about the handshake and how the handshake is universal as well. Epigenetics is something else. So epigenetics is the experiences that you partake in don't change your DNA that you pass on to your offspring, but it changes how the DNA is expressed, passed on to your offspring. So, for example, your diet, chemical exposure, exercise, sleep, water consumption, stress, mental health, 4 months prior to conception, all those factors are going to come into play when you pass on your DNA to your offspring, your baby, how your DNA is expressed in them as a result. We talked about universally how with deception, that if right-handed people look to the left, that's usually more truthful. If they look to the right, that usually indicates being disingenuous. Power usually taking up more space. People mm-hmm. usually, that's more of a power move. Mm-hmm. What they touch, that's usually more of a power move. If they raise their head, that's more of a power move to look down at people. Also, this is something that's interesting, that's more universal, that nonverbal behaviors, oftentimes people think reactionary, that's true, but they also create as well universally. So whatever type of nonverbal behaviors you display, that's going to create the emotion. So there was a study done, two different groups. One group, they had them put a pin in their mouth. The second group, they did not. In group A, with the pin in their mouth, they rated that experience much more emotionally positive than the group that did not. So when you put a pin in your mouth, what's that do? That artificially creates a smile. So if you don't have a positive emotion, if you start to smile, that creates a positive emotion and vice versa. So wow. whatever types of nonverbals we display, that creates the emotion. Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y, she did numerous studies.
Dr. Furlich, we have our time out. And all I can say is thank you, thank you, thank you. I've been talking with Dr. Stephen Furlich for a fascinating discussion. He's been helping us decode the silent, powerful world of nonverbal communication. Your book is just offers practical relations and practical understanding, and I certainly appreciate you for it. To my listening audience, much appreciation for the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes at wfsu.org.